Man's capability of moral elevation and of moral degradation. "I am fearfully and wonderfully made" is a sentiment replete with truth and of momentous significancy. The moral nature of man is such that he cannot at any time be stationary. If in the moral scale he does not ascend, he inevitably descends. He either rises step by step towards that sublime and moral mental elevation of which he is capable, or slides along a slippery declivity which leads to a state of moral degradation far, far below brutality. Man is the only being on earth that is capable of rising above or of falling below itself, and this is a proof of the intrinsic excellency and dignity of human nature. Brutes are neither capable of moral elevation nor degradation, because they have not been constituted by their Creator moral beings, and are consequently incapable of moral action. But man has been constituted a moral being. The faculties of his soul and the organization and symmetry of his body declare him the preeminent production of creative wisdom and goodness. He walks abroad with countenance erect. Intelligence burns in his eyes. Majesty sits enthroned on his countenance. The lamp of reason illumines his soul, and the whole sentient creation do him homage. This is the lofty elevation which by nature the human family have been permitted to occupy. But not only has the nature of man been thus elevated, the earth and its fullness have been given him, an overflowing abundance to minister to all his corporeal wants, and the heavens and the heaven of heavens have been brought into requisition to supply his moral necessities. Possessing an immortal spirit as well as a mortal body, he requires intellectual as well as animal nourishment. He is a link between heavenly and earthly beings, and therefore the subject of the administrations of two worlds. Here then, as upon an elevated site, stands man, the fearfully made, the wonderfully organized child of heaven. Behold his capability of improvement. Although in infancy more helpless than the young of any of the bestial tribes, yet soon strength braces his body, agility renders elastic his limbs, the sun of intellection illumines his mind, and he begins his ascent. Now he lisps with difficulty the names of his parents. Presently he is proficient in many languages. The thunder of his eloquence is heard in the house of God or in the Senate chamber. He captivates, he convulses listening thousands. Or it may be that with Newton he can scan the heavens, or with Locke dissect the human mind, with Hunter the human body, or with Smith develop the deep principles of the human heart. Like Franklin, he may snatch the lightning from the heavens, or like Milton, astonish nations by the sublime melody of poetic numbers, or, what is better, like the benevolent Howard, become an angel of mercy to the sons and daughters of misery and poverty. Almost every nation and every age present cheering examples of the capability of man for improvement, moral and intellectual. And, so lofty have been the intellectual and moral flights of thousands of illustrious men, that we dare not say to the improvable capacity of man, "Thus far shalt thou go, but no farther." From infantile imbecility and ignorance, man may be capable, for aught we know, of winging his intellectual and moral flight to the heights of the heavenly principality, and finally to a pinnacle infinitely exalted above every adoring angel that now surrounds the throne of the Almighty. Eternity, yes, eternity is the ocean to which we are tending. And eternity is the duration which has been appointed for the intellectual and moral improvement of man. Who, then, shall set limits to human improvement? But let it be recollected that this capacity of moral and intellectual improvement, by which we may gain so exalted an elevation, is that which renders us capable of illimitable degradation. We perceive not how it could have been otherwise. Without those principles by the abuse of which men degrade themselves, they would be incapable of moral and mental elevation, as much so as a beast. Therefore, in the proportion in which man is capable of rising above, he is capable of falling below himself. And, as his ascent is slowly progressive, so may be his descent likewise. Very few men have ever been known to rush precipitately into the perpetration of the worst of crimes. They begin by the commission of smaller sins. Perhaps the young man sometimes ventures to swear. His conscience smites, but he refuses to hearken. He ventures occasionally into bad company and becomes a tippler. Without, however, any intention of ever becoming intoxicated, he abhors drunkenness. But evil communications imperceptibly corrupt his heart. He acquires by custom an additional appetite for spirituous liquors, and a taste for the company of his vile associations, and in a short time he becomes not only a tippler but a gambler. Now he is surrounded by the hot and poisonous fumes of every abomination. You may behold him staggering along in the street, falling into the mud, and belching out as if hell abode in his bosom 1,000 imprecations. Ah, poor youth, how thou art fallen! Yonder grunting swine is a more dignified animal than thou. But the worst is not yet told. The young man neglects his business, spends his money for naught. Soon poverty presses upon him, and his sad career ends at the gallows or in the penitentiary. It is true that all vicious young men have not traveled this road so far, but still their vicious course has been the downward road, the pathway of degradation and wickedness, that which, if followed, may lead not only to a shameful state of moral degradation here, but to the society of devils and everlasting fire hereafter. Need we in this place inform the reader that if all men were by nature totally depraved, they would neither be capable of rising above nor of falling below themselves? In no way within the compass of our imagination would they be capable of progression in either virtue or vice. The whole viperous brood would act the viper from birth to manhood and from manhood to the grave. Every power of every human body, soul, and spirit would be brought into active requisition in order to the committing of every possible sin. Every virtuous action would be hated, and every truth abhorred, while every sin, every species of moral corruption would be loved by all the unregenerate with the most intense and unabating affection. Every man throughout the world would hate every other man. Nay, parents would hate their own children, or, if they loved them, they would love a mass of sin. Do we not speak advisedly? If every man in the world were to act in accordance with the appalling picture just drawn, would he be more than totally depraved? Certainly he would not. It follows, then, with the clearness of demonstration that if the doctrine of total hereditary depravity were true, the order of things above described would be immediately superinduced. The whole man would love sin, because sin would be congenial with his nature, and he would hate every good thing, because all goodness would be in perfect opposition to his whole nature, and his whole nature, being wholly corrupt, would, with all its powers, tend to all corruption. We have sometimes seen men who, by a long course of wickedness, rendered themselves so depraved that they were unfit for society. They were hanged until they were dead. Now, these men were not more than totally corrupt. Are all men by nature as depraved as these? Strange, strange that this impossible doctrine would ever have been believed by reasonable creatures. We do believe that this doctrine is totally depraved.